Hello, and welcome back to the Normalize You podcast. I'm your host, Gabby, and today's episode, we have an interviewee. Our interviewee is named Susan Ringwood. After initially training as a teacher, Susan spent more than 35 years working in the nonprofit sector, including 14 years as the CEO of BEAT, the UK's national charity supporting people affected by eating disorders and campaigning on their behalf. She is a fellow of the Academy of Eating Disorders and chaired the Academy's Patient and Careers Committee. She's led the development of the Worldwide Charter for Action on Eating Disorders, and she was the 2008 recipient of the AED Meehan and Hartley Award of Leadership in Advocacy and Public Service. Susan is also a member of the advisory board of the Global Eating Disorders Advocacy Group called FEAST. Today, Susan has recently retired from her professional working life and now lives on the remote Herbidean Isle of Mull off the west coast of Scotland, where she enjoys cycling, watching wildlife, and year-round wild water swimming in the sea, locks, and mountain rivers. So without further ado, I would like to introduce to you Susan Ringwood. Hi, Susan. How are you? Welcome to the Normalize You podcast.
Thank you very much for speaking with me today. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, for sure. Me too. So for those of you that may not know Susan, I wanted to ask you, Susan, if you can tell us a little bit about the charity BEAT and what being part of that mission was like for you in the UK.
I joined BEAT as its chief executive back in 2001, so 20 years ago now. And the day I joined it, it was called the Eating Disorders Association, which was obviously a very different name, and I thought it gave out a very different image of what the organisation might be like. I didn't know anything about eating disorders when I joined that organisation. I didn't think I'd ever met anybody who was affected by an eating disorder. And I only knew what I'd read in the women's magazines and the popular press. So my views were very, very uninformed. It took me about 2 weeks to think, oh my goodness, this is serious. People are dying. I didn't know it was like this. I can't be the only person who knows so little about it. Mm-hmm. I've got this opportunity to lead this charity. I've got to bring about change.
Yeah.
So it was my induction to the organization, which I'd only put myself forward to join because I wanted to see if I was good enough to be a chief executive. Mm-hmm. That was my motivation. It wasn't the condition. But that wasn't why I stayed there nearly 15 years. Yeah. I mean, I stayed there that time because I found it compelling as a cause to understand myself, to represent others, and to be part of trying to bring about the change that needed to be brought about, to mm-hmm. do something about this most frightening, misunderstood, badly treated, confounding illness that was affecting so many people.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you worked there for so many years, you said, and you were part of the board. What were your main takeaways from being part of BEAT?
Well, I suppose when I first started, when I went there as the Eating Disorders Association, it had been set up by family members. It was quite small. It didn't cover the whole of the UK. It was run in a very well-meaning, but not necessarily a professional way as an organisation. And so one of the first things I had to do was raise the money to pay the bills. The very first year, I joined in October. In Christmas, there wasn't enough money in the bank to pay the staff wages for Christmas.
Wow.
Okay, so it very nearly closed as soon as I joined it. So I had to raise money, I had to get the organization together, I had to bring the board together. There was a lot of change that needed to happen. But right at the very beginning, I knew one of the things that needed to change was the whole name of the organization.
Okay.
I learned so early on that it wasn't just young people, but it was mostly young people who were being affected. And if we could get good information and support to them as soon as possible, then they were more likely to make a good recovery and to avoid the long-term adverse consequences of having this illness. So I felt the organization had to be much more aligned around young people's needs.
Mm.
And Eating Disorder Association didn't seem to do it for me.
Yeah.
People told us it was medical, stuffy and dull. I was listening, we had a telephone helpline. I was listening in on this helpline as part of my induction, learning, still learning about this organization. And a young girl, she was 14, she was calling our helpline. And she said, I already feel so ashamed about myself for what I'm doing to myself. I feel even worse that I have to come to the disordered association to get my help.
Interesting.
And I thought, yeah, that's got to change. So looking back now, older, I don't know, wiser, but looking back now, I think it was quite a rash, audacious thing to do, to go in new as a chief executive who'd never run anything, who didn't know about it, to change the name. But I did. Within 18 months, I found the new name. And within the next year, we'd had 300% more young people reaching us for help.
Wow. And
the only thing we changed was the name.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm prouder of that, I think, than almost anything I did to make it an organization that was visible, that was accessible, that people felt able to turn to get the help that they needed.
Of course. And
not put off by some organization they thought it was just for people who were disordered.
Mm-hmm. The stigma attached to the name, I'm sure, is what it was. Yeah.
And it felt like it was something run by doctors. It didn't feel like it was a supportive organization reaching out to anyone. And that was, you know, we had to do an awful lot of consultation, reaching out to stakeholders and people to find, should we change the name? If so, to what? And through that process, learned an awful lot about the organization and the needs of the people who could benefit from the organization if we got it right.
Mm. Got you. And what was that name changed to, for those that don't know, like what it was before?
It was the Eating Disorder Association, and then it mm-hmm. was changed to BEAT, which is Beating Eating Disorders.
Yes, I love that.
It was good. And when it was first written down, it was a letter B and then EAT in two different colors. So it was about B and EAT. The mm-hmm. visual representation of it was about being and eating and how the two come together.
Yeah.
So that was part of the imagery of it and part of the mission of it too.
That's awesome. I love that name. Excuse me. I think it's so different, because normally there's always the word disordered in a lot of these organization names, and there's the feeling of stigma, of a lot of shame and guilt for feeling disordered, quote unquote, or for mm-hmm. feeling different than the population around you. So I think that name is very empowering.
Thank you. Yeah. And it wasn't, you know, it took a long time to find it. We opened it up. We asked everyone to give us suggestions. We got about 400 suggestions came through. 390 of them couldn't be used because they were someone else's domain name. They were the name of a brand of yogurt. They were, you know, they didn't translate into language. You know, we got it down to about 10 quite quickly. And then we lived with those names for a while, to internally as an organization with our staff and our volunteers, just to see how they might work, and you know, just play with them, put them on the walls. And the word BEAT then emerged as our front runner from that process. But we didn't hire any fancy consultants. We did it all ourselves with our own resources. We just did it, partly because we didn't have any money to spend on it. We couldn't have mm-hmm. done it if we could hire image people or something.
That's amazing. So for those that may not know, is BEAT solely like a support charity, like where you can reach out, kind of like phone a friend, kind of phone a line and mm-hmm. talk about your struggles? Or what exactly does the organization, or did the organization do?
Yeah, okay. Well, it had, and I think that was one of the things about it, that from the very beginning, it was both reaching out to people directly affected by eating disorders, to their families, and to the people providing them with their treatment and care. So there was work for professionals, so training, conferencing, just helping them understand what it's like to experience this condition. So articulating the condition for the professionals, which no one else was doing at that point, mm-hmm. Not from the person's own perspective of someone affected by it, telling a professional this is what it's like to have this illness. And I say working with families, but also working with young people. And so holding the ring between those three people and helping parents to understand what their children were experiencing, helping the children to understand what their clinicians might be feeling. And I think for me, as someone who came from the outside, hadn't experienced an eating disorder myself, I think that was one of the strengths in the early days, that no one could say, well, she's only saying that because. Right. So I could hold that tension between those different groups, and I could speak in public about what these are, what the different groups tell me, in a way that anyone could listen to it, because I genuinely didn't have a vested interest.
Got it.
I did just represent the families. I wasn't a doctor. I had no medical background. I hadn't experienced an eating disorder. And I turned that into strength of being able to listen to openly and speak to those people who hadn't necessarily found it easy to listen and speak to each other previously. It was quite a fractured world before.
Yeah.
People weren't really sitting down and listening to them. One of the early things we did was we established something called Beat Ambassadors. And these were all young people who'd had their own direct personal experience of being affected by an eating disorder, and were now sufficiently recovered that with support, they were able to go out and talk to others. And that included going to the Houses of Parliament and talking to our legislators.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah,
that included sitting beside me on the, you know, BBC News and talking to, you know, the nation about what this was like.
Yeah.
As well as talking to people who had the means to give us significant funds if they chose to write a big check for us.
Wow.
So those young ambassadors were a very powerful part of what we were about in the early days, I think.
Yeah. That's amazing. So would you say, because, you know, I'm not as familiar with the UK and eating disorders, I'm more familiar with the US, would you say there's a higher prevalence of eating disorders in the UK versus the US? Is it the same?
I think it's very much the same. From what I understand about the world, it is pretty evenly spread across the world where the data is collected. There are obviously lots of parts of the world where there may not be any access to diagnosis, where there may not be any treatment, so the cases don't get found. But where people look for them, they find them in pretty much the same kinds of numbers.
Yeah.
So I think in terms of UK and US, it was similar.
Okay.
And you asked about what Beat did. I mean, we ran helplines for people, confidential helplines for people who could be people affected. It could be their family members. We would get calls from a general practitioner saying, I've got this patient, what do I do? I don't know what to do with them. So some of our helpline calls would be from medical people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
About 10% of them were silent. And these were people who, even though they'd picked up the courage to call us, weren't able to speak.
Wow.
So just have to listen to that call. And so those were most likely to be the people directly affected, but we wouldn't ever know for certain who those 10% of calls were, because all we could do was speak and listen to them, but they weren't able to speak to us.
Of course. What would you say about the access to resources? I know for me personally, here in the US, I went through an eating disorder. I was, privileged enough to have those resources, to have that access, but access is really tough. It's very expensive for a lot of the eating disorder resources that one needs in order to fully recover, especially here in Houston, at least. So I'm curious what those resources and expenses look like in the UK.
Yeah, it is a different system. It's a different healthcare system. So we do have a public health system. But those resources weren't necessarily available to everyone equally across the UK. There were very few centres with any expertise in treating eating disorder in the early days. So you maybe could get referred to an experienced clinician, but it might be hundreds of miles away from your family home. There would be, some parts of the country that had no specialist services, and particularly no residential services for people. Waiting lists could be 6 months or more, even for an initial consultation. So, yes, the treatment would be freely provided once you found it, but that didn't mean to say you could just pitch up and get that treatment then. So there would be long waits, maybe many miles to travel, and maybe ending up a long way away from home.
Wow.
And a lack of good, good quality evidence-based treatment in the early days.
Got it.
That has changed now. I mean, one of the things that's changed in the past 5 years is a real focus on particularly getting that treatment for young people right where people need it. Every part of the UK has to have a dedicated team where the where an assessment has to be done within 2 weeks if it's urgent, 4 weeks if it's, you know, routine, and mm-hmm. it can be within 24 hours if it's crisis. So those standards are set now, and providers are audited against those by our government. So things have changed a lot in that 20 years since I was first involved with BEAT. But it's still patchy, and it's still not easy for people to get mm-hmm. access to treatment, because you've still got to know, and your family has got to know, that you have got a treatable illness.
Yeah, of course.
If only you asked for the help, you might get it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Which is where the awareness comes in. You know, we surveying people, and they were young people, were it took them 6 months or more before they even realized that what they were experiencing was something that they could maybe be a problem. And once they knew it was a problem, it took them several more months before they even mentioned it to anyone else. And then you might start waiting to get into treatment. You were talking a year or more.
Yeah, that's a long process and waiting game for sure.
Yeah. And I'm sure that, you know, the more we can do to raise that awareness and to make that reaching out into those communities, the more likely it is that someone could turn and recognize it in themselves, and or friends and colleagues would recognize it amongst others, mm-hmm. and feel okay to say to their friend, are you okay? I couldn't help but notice. I was a bit worried about you. Is there anything, you know, to have that conversation with someone who you think might have mm-hmm. a problem? I think it's more likely that that could happen now because the awareness is slightly better. That didn't happen 20 years ago.
Got it. And I have a couple friends from the UK that I've connected with through social media, which has been really cool. And I've learned a lot about eating disorders, how it's like there in the UK. And I know one of my friends was telling me, and it was discussed a bit on social media a while ago, about how the Prime Minister was trying to make it mandatory for certain elementary school students to get like weighed at school, which just blew my mind.
Yes, it does. It does still happen. And it's where this interaction with the obesity issues that people have, and they try and make an intervention with one thing that they understand, and they don't always see the unintended consequences with another. So there has been a big concern about childhood obesity, and they've taken a very kind of, I don't know, unhelpful approach to it, to say it's about somebody's weight and it's about their BMI, and so therefore we will weigh seven-year-olds and measure seven-year-olds, and some people were doing this like publicly, they were lining them up, and some schools were doing this, they were using it as an opportunity to do a math lesson, so they'd weigh
then
they would line them up from the heaviest to the lightest and say, look, here's the distribution, you know, and they would use that as a learning point about, you know, statistics, you know, that was without even thinking what could that do to the people who've been made to stand in rank order of their weight.
That's so detrimental to mental health. I have a little 8-year-old sister, and I just could not even fathom or begin to think having to have her be weighed is just insane.
Yes. And also the you know, one of the things we even now are still campaigning routinely, being weighed in the doctor's room for all kinds of things that, you know, aren't necessary. Why do you need to be weighed for this? I have asthma. Okay, my asthma is controlled. There's no problem with it. I go to the doctor's room for my annual asthma check, and the nurse asks to weigh me. Okay. So I had clothes on, but I slipped off my shoes and I stood on the scale. The nurse looked at me and said, don't cheat.
And I said, oh, what?
And I said, I beg your pardon. She said, you've taken your shoes off. So she did then get the short lecture on how to speak to someone. I said, you don't know my situation. If I was this person who had these issues, if you said that to me, I would never come back in here again, whether for my asthma or anything else, you would not see me again.
Oh my gosh.
It had not occurred to her that that was a harmful thing to say to somebody.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. I've never had an experience like that. I mean, I will say when I was 8 years old, I went to my pediatrician at the time, and I was put on a diet because he told mm-hmm. me that I was overweight, borderline obese, and I was very high mm-hmm. on the percentile rank of the BMI range. And lo and behold, I was put on a diet at 8, 9 years old, which is crazy, but.
But, you know, what we know now is that BMI is not a reliable measure for children's growth.
No.
Children grow, they are growing, they're changing every single day. You know, they can be, becoming tall and slender almost overnight from being shorter and not slender the day before. So, you know, you cannot use children's height and weight to determine their health status. We can't use anybody's health.
No.
Height and weight for health status, particularly children. Their health status is not determined by their height and their weight.
Definitely not. 100% agree. So I know you had said that you kind of retired from the work of Beat and whatnot. So what are you doing right now then? Are you still staying involved in some sort of eating disorder community or?
Yes, I am. So I'm still involved with Feast, which is an international advocacy community that's has its organizational base in the US, but has links all over the world, particularly in the UK, in Canada, in Australia, and New Zealand, in Israel. There are quite a few other places as well where we've got very good connections. I'm on their advisory board. So I did serve on their board of directors for my terms there. Feast started out as just parents. I don't say just, but it was in, they were constitutionally about supporting parents. And that's where they came from. And during my time, before my time there, they widened that to bring in people with other kinds of expertise who could be, help advise them and help steer them towards some of the other issues that are around. So that's why they now have quite a wide-ranging advisory board of either clinicians or other advocates or people who can, you know, just pitch in with our ideas when we're asked for them.
Wow, that's so awesome.
I'm very proud to be part of that.
Yeah. And for those that may not know, what does FEAST stand for?
FEAST stands for Families Empowered and Active Supporting Treatment.
I love that. I think that's so necessary. It's very important to have your familial support. And if you can't have familial support, some sort of support in recovery and seeking treatment, because it's hard. It's really hard to do.
Absolutely. And some of those families can be your family of choice. They may not be your family of birth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not everybody does have a family around them. That's not to say that families cause the problem, but not everybody does have a family who's available to them or has the, you know, the ability to be able to support them. So that's why the wider kind of support community being out there so that you can be part of that family of choice is really important as well, I think.
Yeah. Well, speaking.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say the only other thing I still do is the Academy for Eating Disorder have some involvement with them as well, and still hold a fellowship with the Academy for Eating Disorders, and was the first person, not a clinical person, a medical person, to be offered a fellowship. So I feel very, very pleased about that.
Yeah, that's incredible and very rare. So that's amazing. Congratulations on that. That's really cool. I was going to say, since you're on the topic of families, what advice or what is your perspective on an individual that doesn't have any familial support and maybe doesn't have any support at all, or they have a family that is very entrenched in diet culture and is almost perpetuating the behaviors more?
I think that's so tough because as you said, it, you know, it's even though you alone can overcome your eating disorder, you can't do it on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Right? No one can recover for you.
Exactly.
You have to be the person to recover. You have to do it, but you can't do it. It is so much harder to do it on your own.
Mm-hmm.
I think fortunately, another thing that's maybe changed in the 20 years since I was first involved is the growth of the internet. And now there are more online resources available, ones that are credible, ones that are supportive, positive. Out there, you know, Beat and Feast and the other organizations that have grown up in the other countries around the world will can put people in touch with others. There's like mentor programs, there's good information out there. So, you know, if you can't speak to someone directly, you could start by looking online for a good source and see what you could find there. Mm-hmm. But it's also about friends looking out for each other. And that's something that I feel so much more hopeful about with the young generations that I see now, is that you are all more supportive of each other than people were 20 years ago. You know, you do look out for each other more, and I think you're more accepting and you're kinder. So I've got great faith in the young people coming forward today that they would be more likely to reach out and help one of their fellows who they thought was suffering than they would be to stigmatize them and ostracize them and bully them.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think something that's been really amazing to see, you know, when Instagram first came out, for example, just as a social media platform, for me, it was very toxic. And I fell through a lot of comparison and thinking I wasn't good enough. And I saw everybody's life as a highlight reel, and they were never unhappy or never struggling with mental health. And, you know, about a year or so ago, I started opening up about my history with my eating disorder, and the outpour of love and the support and people saying like, me too, I understand where you're coming from, things like that. I mean, making friends from the UK that have struggled with eating disorders and have been openly speaking to me about it. I just, when you curate your feed and you curate who you want to be surrounded by, it's crazy how much positive energy and love you can be surrounded by.
I think so. Yeah. But that's great. And I'm really pleased to hear that. It does take bravery to do it though. And I think,
yes, yes,
you know, can need that extra push or that extra encouragement to, because you are exposing yourself, aren't you? But
yes. Yeah.
You know, what is the worst that could happen? You know, it's worth taking that step to see if you can find that help. And you will soon find those people who can get it and can support you, and they may be in the most unlikely places. You know, we've had young people who said it was actually their grandmother who was the person who got it, and that they could talk to, and who realized that this was something that had been in the family for two or three generations and no one had ever said anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure you've dealt with navigating a lot of cultural barriers with individuals that are going through treatment.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. That can be a really strong thing for people to understand. And particularly in the UK, it was an issue with people from the Asian subcontinent. So that was a real big issue with them, because the young girls' lives were so controlled anyway, that they had very little agency themselves. And that could sometimes, if they were already hardwired to be vulnerable to this eating disorder, it could be the extra thing that made it more likely that they could develop it.
Oh yeah, 100%. I come from a Peruvian background. My mom is full blood Peruvian, and so the Latin culture, dieting is huge. Diet culture is big. Everyone's on a diet all the time. And you know, my grandma and my aunts and my cousins would always say like, oh, just lose 10 more pounds and you'll just look great. You know, just get on this diet. It's for your good. Like, just always striving to be thinner. And it was just so normalized for so long. And I never thought anything wrong about it. So it's crazy, the cultural disconnect I think there was with regards to diet culture and how harmful it really is.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it is still very pervasive. I think there's still, yes, a lot that we need to be able to do that. I think one of the things that has improved is the people have now got a better understanding of the power of the image. I think, you know, the early part of the 20th century, it was all about the power of the word. That was how we transmitted culture. That was how we transmitted ideas. That was how we communicated. 21st century, it's all about the image. It's how do we show ourselves, the picture that we use. And so now we have to get that literacy around the visual image.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are beginning to do that now. They know it's manufactured. They're beginning to understand how things are created, to be able to have that distance and go, yeah, but hang on, it's not really like that.
Yeah.
And to begin to understand the difference that it makes to have that critical faculty to be able to understand the images that you're bombarded with.
Yeah.
And know the impact they have on you.
Yeah. Personally, I'm curious as to what you think, but personally, I feel like when it comes to any social media platform or any media platform for that matter, there needs to be more regulation. Like, you shouldn't be able or allowed to post anything that isn't who you are, that's manufactured and extremely photoshopped, because that just impacts so many people in such a negative way. And I think it would cut back on that significantly if people were regulated on what they could post.
I know. It's an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. And was certainly involved in lots of the conversation around this. And people were saying, well, maybe we could just put a sticker on that says this image has been altered.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it doesn't work like that, because the way our brains work, the visual has primacy in terms of how we interpret the world. We see something, the image goes straight into a very primitive part of our brain where we react to it, because it might be a mammoth coming over the hill that's going to trample us or something. So we're still like cavemen. We respond to the image, all right, as a threat or whatever. We see the image, and then our critical faculties come in and go, oh no, hang on a minute, wait, that's not maybe like that.
Yeah.
But we've already had that emotional response by then. Mm. Okay, so we respond first to the image, then we evaluate it.
Yeah.
So by just putting a sticker on it doesn't help. You've already had the emotional response.
Yeah.
And for some people, they may, because of, you know, the brain is starved or any other reason, that their critical faculties are impaired. Mm. They may not be able to go, yeah, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
And do that on the other hand bit that you can do when you've got, you know, all of your faculties working in your favor.
Of course. Yeah, no, that's so true. I didn't think about it that way. So then what do you think we can do? What do you think is more realistic to prevent that altering?
I think it is the discussion. I think it is making people more aware of it. I think there is something about the, you know, just having the debate, but also looking at what would be the sanctions for people who did particularly and noxiously manipulate what was going on. But it's, there isn't one piece of legislation that works worldwide on this.
Yeah.
And that's the main issue, you know, particularly with the internet. You can't, you might do it with print, physical print media, but you can't do it on the web because there is no place that can control the whole of it.
Yeah, exactly. So true.
That's the issue. So I think it's more about educating all of us to have more of those critical faculties and be able to use them to understand what it is we're looking at, and to be able to understand what we need to do when we feel a certain way when we see things.
Yeah. It amazes me, because sometimes I'll see some images like in my explore feed, not necessarily people I don't follow anybody that would kind of do that stuff, because I'm just not who I am, but sometimes I'll come across some images and it is so photoshopped, like it is so visibly photoshopped. It amazes me that they don't see that, or that they're not like, oh wow, this is very obvious. This doesn't look great. Like, you know?
Yeah, I know. It is extraordinary, but it is so I mean, one of the things I did was work with the fashion industry to encourage them to be inclusive of a wider variety of body shapes and sizes on the catwalk. And we did this with London Fashion Week back in 2010, where we, for the first time, showed catwalk models who were, they were a UK size 12, which would be, what's that, a 14?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, a US size 14. And this was jaw-droppingly shocking to the people who sat on that catwalk. When this woman walked out, you literally heard their jaws drop to the floor and the intake of breath, because they had never seen such a sight in their life.
Believe it.
This beautiful, beautiful woman, and it was outrageous. It made the press all around the world that this person had walked in this catwalk, and it was the first time that anyone had ever done it. It was extraordinary. And we had some photographs taken. A guy called Rankin, he's a fashion photographer, and Rankin did the pictures, and they didn't manipulate any of them. They were beautiful photographs of these models, but they tidied up a stray hair or something.
Yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm. They didn't change the shape, the size, the complexion, anything about the physical properties of the body weren't changed. You know, they just made, the lighting was lovely, the makeup was lovely, but they didn't make the neck longer and the shoulders, you know. They didn't.
Yes, yeah.
And I showed these pictures to the Alexander Shulman, who was the editor of Vogue, and I sat down with her in her room at Vogue.
Wow.
Very nice. Feeling, oh my goodness. I sat in this room in Vogue and I showed her these pictures and said, look, these are the pictures we've got, and they haven't been shot. And she said, oh, I can see that. I can see they haven't been touched.
Wow.
One of the women was, it was her back view and her head was turned around. So you could mostly see the back view, but the head. And so you could see the back of her knee behind her kneecap.
Mm-hmm.
And Shulman pointed to this tiny, tiny dimple behind her knee. And she said, I can tell you haven't shopped them because we would have taken that out.
Oh my gosh. Wow. I'm speechless. That's crazy. What was your reaction?
It's just bewildering at the time, you know, because that's when you make you realize how invidious this is, that it would never have occurred to me that the tiny dimple that everyone must have behind their knee is the kind of thing that's not deemed to be suitable to be shown in Vogue magazine.
It's crazy. I don't think anybody would have really paid attention to that minor detail had it not been pointed out.
But you probably have, because it's probably gone straight into your brain, you know, and you've probably created this image of what legs ought to look like, not realizing that the behind your knee has always been removed before you saw them.
That's so true. That's crazy. So how did that conversation close? Was it a positive one or not?
It was positive. I mean, she was interested. You know, she wasn't unaware of the degree of challenge, but she published the pictures. Our pictures, so there was a spread about them, so she did create an editorial around it, so she was supportive, but she also knew that the amount of challenge that it was going to take to change it, because there were people who thought it was ugly to see that dimple behind your knee.
That's crazy. Oh, all bodies are so beautiful and so unique, and I just feel like they should be celebrated, and it just hurts my heart to think that like people would be angered by something because it shows a freaking dimple on the back of their knee.
Checking your knee now. You'll be getting a mirror to see if you can see that dimple.
I'm very curious now. Yeah, I'm going to go in a mirror and like look, because I've never paid attention.
There's a tiny fold in your skin. You can probably even feel it. They would take that out so there was no fold in your skin.
That's just abnormal and insane.
Yes, it is insane. And I did work with some really interesting people in that fashion world who were trying to make change, but I also worked with some of the most toxic people I have ever worked with in my life. I got abusive mail. I got emails that I had to delete from my personal account because I didn't even like the thought of them sitting in my inbox. They were so toxic.
Wow. Oh my gosh. That's crazy.
Yeah. There were some people who found it very, very threatening. They were really personally threatened by the fact we were trying to bring in this kind of change, and their response to that was to kick out with a lot of hate and a lot of negativity.
Oh, that's so awful. But I just think that's so incredible that you got to sit with people and make that kind of change. I mean, to me, that's revolutionary. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, and simple things like the casting that they used to do for the fashion shows. Young girls would be given just an address and they'd have to go off on their own at night, some back street, and find the photographer and do, you know, and we got them to change that. So they did it in the daytime in a public place. They would go to an hotel and the people would do the casting there and then with everyone around. And we would be invited to go in and take our ambassadors and just sit and chat with people. And it, you know, became a much more healthy environment. To, we weren't stopping people being models, but we were looking at what else could we do to make world one that was more positive and healthy for everyone rather than the really pleasant place that it had become.
I'm sure those models that got calls were very thankful and grateful for you guys.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. That's awesome. Thank you so much. This was such a fun conversation to have. I really enjoyed talking to you and getting to know more about you and what you've been involved in and how much of an advocate you've been for this community. It's really commendable and I really appreciate it.
Thank you. No, thank you. And I suppose, you know, right at the very beginning when, you know, why did I stay with it? And I suppose quite early on, I thought, what protected me? Mm. Why did I not develop an eating disorder? What was it, you know, about the way my brain is wired or, you know, my experiences? I don't know, because the more I learned about it, you know, I'm a perfectionist, I'm competitive, you know, I've got lots of the personality traits that seem to make people vulnerable, but maybe my brain's just not hardwired in that way. So there, but for the grace of God, for some reason, something protected me, and I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
But if we could find out what it was.
Yeah, and give it to everybody.
That would make, you know,
yeah,
what a difference it would make.
That's crazy. I think that's awesome that you did have that protective factor and that you were still able to get involved in the community and make a change, because that's very rarely seen.
No, well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Pleasure talking to you as well. Thank you so much.